Welcome to Slab Reliability, the show where we learn about SRE and observability one week at a time. I'm your host, Stephen Townsend. Welcome back to Slab Reliability. I'm Stephen Townsend, and this is the show where we learn about SRE and observability and DevOps one week at a time. Today, I am here from Etiel from Commodore. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Happy to be here.
I'm happy to be here too. We haven't actually met yet, so would you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure thing. So my name is Etiel Schwartz, and I'm the CTO and co-founder of Commodore. In my past life, or like my background, like I studied computer science and psychology, but ever since I've done mainly backend, infra, SRE, like whatever you want to call it. I worked at eBay in the beginning of my career, and since then I joined the smaller and smaller companies. I worked at a company called Forter, where I was like one of the first employees, and then a company named Rookout, where I was the first developer, and since then they were acquired by Dynatrace. And then I co-founded the Commodore. Basically, we make Kubernetes accessible for humans. And that means we simplify most of the heavy lifting around Kubernetes, if it's troubleshooting or day-to-day operation.
I think that leads nicely into today's topic, which is, why is Kubernetes so hard? Which I think is for me quite an interesting topic, because I've used Kubernetes a little bit in my career, and I've heard from a lot of people about how challenging it can be. And there is so much to know, so many layers of abstraction, so many bits of terminology that you need to learn. So I think it's a pretty interesting topic. So I guess the first, just to start off, why do you think Kubernetes is so hard, unless you're a hardcore expert?
I think even for like a hardcore expert, Kubernetes can be challenging sometimes. I think Kubernetes is hard. I mean, I will say like maybe two reasons. First of all, Kubernetes in its essence capture all of your system architect and different like services and component. Usually it interacts with the compute layer, the network layer, the storage layer. Like when you say Kubernetes is hard, it's a bit like saying your architecture is complex or your AWS AWS environment is complex. And that is true. Your AWS environment is complex, and architecture in like large scale enterprises is indeed hard. I think Kubernetes has this like a misleading trait of making it super easy to onboard. Like even like a 6 year old can do kubectl apply and he have his first services. Like it's misleading easy to get started, and it's very, very easy to shoot yourself in the leg. So I think Kubernetes is much simpler than, you know, I worked with Bare Metal, EC2, Chef, Puppet, Ansible, and so on. I think Kubernetes is much simpler than that, but it has like a promise that everything is going to be simple, and that promise is not true. So I think it's more like a marketing thing of, you know, marketing Kubernetes as something simple compared to the reality, which is, you need to know what you're doing in Kubernetes or to have the right tools in place. But I think it's so easy to get started and it's misleading. But what do you think about that?
You see, I think you know a lot more about Kubernetes than I do. But a couple of weeks ago, I caught up with your colleague, Yudi, who talked about the whole idea of the DevOps revolution and how companies and people all around the world wanted to do this cloud-native thing. And so many people adopted Kubernetes. And like you said, there's this promise, right, that if you do this, it's going to be easier and simpler and faster. And as you said, that promise wasn't fulfilled. I really like that. Part of it as well is with Kubernetes, we are trying to create a layer of abstraction between the people, the engineers using it, and the hardware. And I think that carries an expectation that developers are going to be more involved. So I think that's another part of it, is we're no longer... infrastructure, the stuff that we run our software on, is no longer in the realm of the infrastructure team. It's something that developers have to get involved in. I think that's quite a tricky thing to manage.
I think you are right. I think what Kubernetes has done, again, it's like, I won't say it's like purely marketing, but there's also like a lot of marketing around that when you adopt Kubernetes, you sometimes expect the rest of the team to take bigger and bigger ownership on the services and on their like the production environment. And that means that, again, like, let's go back like 5 years ago, right? Like not maybe 10 years ago, I don't know, like Chef Puppet, Jenkins, Bare Metal EC2. And if you want like a really like even further, like we can go to like on-prem environment. Then there wasn't any expectation, right? When I had my magic chef thing that spin up the relevant machines and do all of the configuration, there wasn't any expectation from the developers to own their chef or Puppet or configuration. Like, it was given that ops people are going to do that. When migrating to Kubernetes, it's like, again, we're doing two things at the same time. On one hand, we need to learn a new technology as like platform engineers or Kubernetes operators. We need to learn the bits and bytes of how do I use Kubernetes, how do I understand how things are really working. And it's not easy to operate Kubernetes only from like a infra perspective. But a lot of the time, companies also like assume that in a magical way, Kubernetes, like developers will also take responsibilities on owning their applications inside Kubernetes. So we're both changing the infra layer, but also the culture layer. And, you know, again, like, it's not that it's not possible. We see and we help a lot of companies achieve that, and we see companies achieving that as well. But it's not something that you can get as a, you know, or like as an afterthought. Like, ah, yeah, now my developers are going to be good around Kubernetes, or they will own their system. It doesn't work like that. Like, there's a cultural differences. There's a tooling problem. There's like a lot of things that need to happen in order for you as an organization to get the most out of Kubernetes.
I completely agree that there's a real culture change going from developers who just develop to developers who are now expected to work with platforms like Kubernetes or whatever else it is to sort of also be looking at platforms and infrastructure.
A lot of the time, there's also some misalignment. Like, in the end of the day, let's say, you know, you are an SRE, right? And you're getting your salary to make sure that all of the infra is running correctly, and you're doing a lot of ops things in order to achieve that, right? Like, that's why companies pay SRE. But sometimes it's like, now do all of that, but also develop me like some front-end, application, right? Go learn React and do the front-end for everything you are doing. And it doesn't make sense, right? Like, you're very skilled at one thing. You're also getting paid, and your compensation, your KPI, your OKR, whatever, is based on the system reliability. But now all of the sudden, the organization decide you to be like a front-end engineer, but you are not really measured on that or being, you know, no one is giving you like an extra bonus in the end of the year on that. So in a lot of times we see like a misalignment between the fact that they want developers to be in charge of the part of the infra and their application in production, but they don't give the relevant time or the relevant like treats or the relevant KPIs in order to really achieve that. And then as a developer, you are like, think about yourself again as an SRE. You are not going to say, oh, I'm going to not tune the database right now, and I'm going to do this front-end application. Like, it doesn't make any sense for you, right? You're going to do the database. And like, if you need like a front-end, you will escalate it to the front-end team in your company and tell them, hey, please write this like a bullshit application. Someone asked me to do it, but I have no idea. And I think that's what we're seeing in a lot of companies. Like, they are trying to do this shift, but other than saying that, like, we expect you to do X, Y, and Z, they don't really do anything else to support it.
If everyone does everything, then no one is a specialist anymore. And I think there's not a lot to be said about cognitive load, cognitive burden. There's only so many things that any person can be really expert in or even proficient in. And the broader we make that scope, I think, the harder it can be on our engineers in terms of, you know, stressing them out, burning them out, that kind of thing as well. Maybe another angle to that.
No, I agree. Like, you know, you can't know everything. That's, I think, important. And as SREs or like as platform engineers, we need to find the right balance between like too much abstraction and too little abstraction, which is a very hard task. But we need to do something like that, because we can't expect all of the developers to be SRE. Like, it doesn't make sense.
I thought I'd share my kind of embarrassing Kubernetes thing, which used to get me, is that when we first started using Kubernetes in our SRE enablement team, we set up this Grafana dashboarding sort of platform that, and I understood Kubernetes natively, and we had manifest files to describe our resources. When it came to Helm charts, I just couldn't. I have not to this day got my head around Helm charts. I don't understand. How do you go from I have a manifest, I'm explaining my resources, to Helm charts? I don't understand.
I'll be honest. Like Helm is like a, has a, like a really deep area in my heart, and we also have like an open source project in Commodore called Helm Dashboard. So I'm a very big Helm fan. And I think like Helm contribute to the success of Kubernetes more than almost any other tool in the ecosystem, because it made it very, very easy to package application and to deploy them across different organizations, like to create this like shared package library. But I will say, when I just started using Kubernetes, you know, I try to learn as much as I can, and I try to be like skilled in what I do. And then someone pitched Helm to me. It was like 7 years ago, something like that. And I couldn't like wrap my hand around it. I said, like, I understand that there are package managers. Like there is Pip, right, for example. I love Python, or like there is Maven. And I understand the part that you can package application. That makes sense to me. There's also template languages. And I also understand that. And I understand that there are things that you can template and change their values. But I didn't understand, and there's like, obviously there are things that allow me to deploy my code to production, right? Like I also understand that, like again, in Python, maybe it's like a bit of like a JUnicorn or something like that. That is like, it's not the real application, but it manages the real application. So I figure out like, I know all of those things, but I couldn't figure out how a single tool that is not that sophisticated in the end of the day claims to do all of those things. And I was in a lecture by like a very, very like one of the core maintainers of, I don't know, like a Kubernetes or Helm, where he explained like why is it so good, and like I felt after this, after like an hour and a half, that I see the light, saw the light, and I changed all of the company that I used to work like to work with Helm, and I never looked back ever since. But I think really Helm is one of the most unorthodox piece of software that I ever saw. Like it does so many things, and it does all of them in like nothing is really good, but somehow the sum is greater than the sum of its part. Like it's really not that good around templating, it's really not that good around the deployment part, and as a package manager it's also not that good. and yet I have like, I really love Helm. Like I think again, like Kubernetes wouldn't be in the place that it is without Helm. And I think Helm is like a hackathon project by these guys.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, sometimes I feel that that's like, that we're still inside of a very like sophisticated hackathon. Yeah.
So we have the situation where we have Kubernetes, lots and lots of companies are using it. We have developers who are sort of being asked to bring Kubernetes into their world, and they're sort of having to take that on. There's also, for everyone involved, it can be really complicated. So what do you think the impact on the industry is of Kubernetes not fulfilling that promise that we talked about?
I think I'll just say one thing. You know, I am a Kubernetes fan in the end of the day, and my company also like really helps inside in the Kubernetes ecosystem for companies. And we have like our platform that enables that. But Kubernetes, when tuned correctly, is I think the best piece of software that was written in the last decade or so, right? Mm. I think, again, it's much, much, much better than all of the alternatives. So I will say like I think Kubernetes can live to the hype. It is just very hard achieving that. You need the experience and you need the relevant tools to support you. And I think what we see in the industry is mainly, and I see it for a lot of our customers, that they try to onboard Kubernetes on the first time, they fail miserably, like everything like goes up in flames, and then they are treading much more lightly and they are trying to migrate to Kubernetes like one step at a time. So I think what we're seeing is like all of the industry starting to figure out that Kubernetes is today the standard. Like if you are not using Kubernetes, it's weird. And all of them are trying to use Kubernetes, and I think like a year or 2 years ago, it wasn't that common to say, oh, Kubernetes is very complex and it's hard to deploy. But I think now we're at the maturity step that people understand that it is complex and that you do when doing this migration to Kubernetes, you do need to tread lightly. Or at least that's what I hope that the industry is going through. But most of our big customers and most of the people that I talk in like big companies, they had like at least one failed migration to Kubernetes story. So that's, I think like that's what happens for everyone, which means, you know, a lot of time, resources being spent around doing something that in the end go to the trash can. So I think the impact is mainly around that, like around a lot of fail experiments. But I think Kubernetes is increasing the velocity of our industry. And I think, again, like compare that to anything else, I think it's like a 10x better. But again, I am a Kubernetes fanboy, right? Like important to say.
I think that one of the other impacts potentially is because it is hard and you need good people who really know Kubernetes to get the most out of it. You can end up as an organization relying on a few sort of experts who really know their stuff. So I know if you've read the Phoenix Project, that's the character of Brett.
This
one guy who knows everything and the company's like, please.
Bert, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he always saved the day. I think that companies still, like, some of them are still trying to work that way. You know, have this one person that is like the single point of failure and knows everything, but it doesn't scale. And with Kubernetes, it's even harder to scale this person or this team. Like we have a saying in the company that it's much easier in Kubernetes to spin up more nodes and more machines than it is to increase the size of the platform team. Like you can spin clusters in seconds, but to find the Kubernetes expert, it's like a ordeal, right? Like it takes you months of recruiting, and you're going to end up with someone who is not that good, probably, right? Like unless you're Google, Amazon, Meta, whatever, and those guys do have the budget to make it work, but most companies are not billion-dollar company, right? That they're also their core is technology, so you need to cheat somehow.
If you're not a Google or a Meta and you've got these massive salaries to attract the best people, how do you empower, you know, developers or just any engineer who's not yet a deep expert in Kubernetes to be more self-sufficient and capable?
I think it's a combination of both a culture change and a tooling change, like in the same time. So you need to make sure that you have the right tools in place. And Commodore is like one example, right? But also have the right observability. If it's the Grafana stack, Grafana, Prometheus, Loki, if it's the Kibana stack with Elasticsearch, or Datadog or Dynatrace, it doesn't really matter. But in Kubernetes, without having like the right observability in place, you are going to be blind. If you're a big company, you also need something to help you manage the cluster themselves. So again, like might be Commodore, or might be tools like OpenShift or Rancher or Tanzu. So you need the tooling, and you need to understand that you are in a journey. And that's what I always tell companies that, you know, are doing the migration. Don't think about it as a sprint. It's a much, much, much more closely to marathon. If you are a company that is, let's say, like 10 years old, not a super legacy company, but you are not cloud native from the beginning, migrating to Kubernetes will probably going to take you a couple of years. And that means that even if you don't have the right expertise currently in the team, you can develop it, you can build it. So you need to have inside the platform team the relevant experts to make sure that you have this knowledge inside your company. You can hire it, you can train it, but you need that. And then you need to find the people who will be your disciples? I don't know, like the students of Kubernetes inside the, how do you say it? The people who will spread the news inside the organization. And you need to find the developers who have the most to gain by using Kubernetes. It might be around scale, it might be around CD, it might be around fault tolerance, it might be around cost. I'm not sure like what is it. You need to find those, you need to make sure that those people enjoy Kubernetes, and then it will work organically. Like almost every successful migration to Kubernetes story I heard was around what features can I give this dev team so they will love us and they will spread the news, you must use Kubernetes. So I think like that's the way to go. But again, like sometimes companies look at Kubernetes as like six-month plan. It's not going to take 6 months. Like it's like unless you have like one service or whatever, it's not going to take 6 months. It's probably a couple of years project. And once you have this set of expectation, it's much easier to, you know, to align yourself, right? You'll do different things if I tell you it's a 2 years project compared to a 6 months project. So I think that's like very important to remember.
Most of my career has been in non-tech companies, sort of reasonably large established companies. And it's, you don't just go to Kubernetes because you can't just take necessarily a bunch of monolithic applications and just host them in containers. That doesn't solve anything or necessarily help anyone. I think there's a whole other step before that, which is how can we break up our monoliths into smaller services that fit the model, you know, fit the containerized model a bit better. Something else I've heard, and I don't know what you think about this, is that in like 2024, we now have access to like serverless technologies. And so I have heard the opinion, well, let's just skip containers altogether and go straight to serverless. What do you think of that? Is there any sort of viability in it?
I am a Kubernetes fanboy, right? And I'm hearing the serverless promise for the last 10 years. Like, it's not new. It's not like in 2024, someone wake up and say, oh, like, I invented serverless. Like, I hear the same promises over and over and over again. I do think that serverless or functions has a place in the space. Like, I think sometimes it's a very valid solution to choose. I think managing, again, like a large infra, a large application only on top of like serverless, I don't think it is possible. I think what makes much more sense is some combination. Containers by themselves, I think, again, this technology already won. Like the ability to package your container, like your Docker, in a single file, in a very easy to use manner. I think like the battle is won there. Like, I think in the end of the day, you should use that. And, you know, AWS Lambda already support like Docker containers. And Fargate and Google also have their like Lambda container, whatever. So I think there is a place to serverless or like to function as a service type of models. But I think there are going to be containers. And I also think that like there is going to be a merge. I see a lot of very cool projects around serverless on top of Kubernetes. You have FN, you have Fission, you have Knative. There's like a lot of projects that looks quite promising and are getting a lot of like adoption. And I do think that we're going to see more and more of those projects. But, you know, like, it doesn't make sense if your company is like 300 developers. The problem is not necessarily around the infra management. It's around the testing, the pipeline, the knowledge, the how is everything orchestrated together. So, you know, will this be the year of serverless? I doubt it. I think like serverless does have some use cases where it fits perfectly and you should probably use it. And I think serverless and Kubernetes combined is going to be something that we're going to see much more in the future. But again, like I am talking as someone that, you know, from day one, I love the Kubernetes and not really like, I never understood how a company, again, with like a couple of hundred of developers can operate in a serverless mode. But, you know, I might be wrong here.
You talked about observability of Kubernetes before. So in my past life as a performance engineer, I did a lot of like monitoring before the term observability sort of came about. And I had some sort of standard things that I would look at. So for like physical servers and virtual servers, it was always the four CPU memory disk network. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of like services and measuring the performance during a test or during log analysis, I'd look at things like response time and error rate and those kinds of things. When I did Kubernetes for about a year and a half, I kind of came up with my own set of things which I thought were important to monitor. Mm-hmm. But do you have a sort of a set of core things that you should monitor in Kubernetes?
No, it's a great question. I think the four like main like things to monitor are the same. I think like if you have your application, then monitoring CPU, memory, latency, and error rate makes total sense, and you should do it. And if you are not doing that, like go do it. But I think in Kubernetes there are two other layers that you also need to monitor. First of all, is changes. Like I think Kubernetes is a very, very, very dynamic environment. Mm. And in turns, if you don't track in a very easy way, like all of the changes that happen inside your clusters, things are going to get messed up. You're going to see very high latency, very high error rate without understanding why is it. And the reason might be that someone just changed a config map that was dynamically loaded. It might be something else, right? But I think changes is becoming like the five thing that you have to monitor. And the second thing that I will say is in Kubernetes, you have a very weird infra to application synergy. Like in the end of the day, let's say that we're running on AWS, right? Because it's the most popular one. And EC2 machine is like a hardware, right? Like it's a, like a bare metal computer or VM or whatever. But in Kubernetes, we don't call it like EC2 machine anymore, right? We called it a node. And on top of that node, we don't have containers. We have those pods. And there's some synergy or some feedback loop between those infra and application. And you need to make sure that you monitor that as well. Like, it's not enough that you'll monitor only the CPU of the node and the CPU of the application. You need to make sure that you understand how they affect one another. If the node is under pressure, your application is not going to work as effectively. And if your application is misbehaving, it might kill the node. And this sort of connection is something that is super hard to do. Again, like in Commodore, we try to help with that. But it's super hard to do. And on the other hand, without that, you are going health blind to operate your Kubernetes clusters.
We're almost out of time, but I was just curious, what's Commodore up to this year? What are you excited about? What's upcoming? What's changing in your world?
I think the most exciting thing for us is to expand our offering. Like in the end of the day, when we started the company, we strive to be the best troubleshooting platform out there, meaning if you have a Kubernetes problem, solve it as fast as possible. And we did it in like such a good and easy way. Like we are reducing the complexity in such a manner that not only operation people who are our first target audience started using us, but also developers and support. So we were able to make everyone into like a Kubernetes expert when it comes to troubleshooting. But the most interesting thing that we are experiencing is becoming from something which is a point solution into something which is much bigger than that, like a reliability platform for Kubernetes. And that includes both the reactive troubleshooting piece, but also proactive analysis for your clusters. So we are able to do things like tell you that your Kubernetes version is going to get end of life by the cloud provider, or that you are using a deprecated API, or you didn't update this Helm chart like for 2 years, and to help you to set up the relevant policies in place, and also a bit of security features and cost capabilities, cost reduction. So, you know, what I love is to hear the audience and to make sure that the product can solve a real big problem inside Kubernetes. And I think Commodore is doing a transformation from something that is great for troubleshooting, both for developers and operation people, to a full modern Kubernetes management platform, if you will, around solving everything inside Kubernetes, both for the platform engineers, the SREs, the developers, like everything you need in Kubernetes in one single place. And that gets me very excited. And I also see like a lot of very interesting use cases in the industry, like more and more companies are migrating to Kubernetes, and that in turn bring new pains, new use cases, and new value points that Commodore can offer. So I'm also very excited about that. Kubernetes on edge, IoT, things like that are becoming more and more popular. So also very interesting.
Do you also have a podcast about Kubernetes? Is that right?
Yeah. I have the Kubernetes for Humans podcast. It's about Kubernetes, and it's mainly for like platform engineers. But I think most of the episode there is simply around how do I take this very elaborate system that I have and make it accessible for other people, developers, data engineers, and so on. I'll be happy to have you as a guest. I'm not sure if it's legal to invite you in the middle of your own podcast, but I'll be happy to have you as a guest as well.
I'd love to be a guest. I just don't know if I know enough or have enough experience in Kubernetes. It's been a couple of years since I worked on it, actually, other than doing some demo stuff by myself.
I think, again, it's much more on the challenges of how do I build a system that other people can use effectively. Like, even we are talking about Kubernetes, it's much more, again, like between this culture and technology like problem.
This episode was sponsored by SquidUp. SquidUp combines your data with awesome dashboards, analytics, health rollup, and notifications into a unified observability portal. Using a data mesh architecture, SquidUp is a beautifully simple way to get instant access to the insights that matter whenever you need them. If you want to know more, head over to squidup.com and to sign up for your free account. Thank you so much, ETL, for coming on the show. Anything else you wanted to say before we sign off today?
No, thanks. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
And to everyone else, hope you have a wonderful week, and I'll see you all next time.